The White Privilege Podcast. I'm your host, Very White Guy. My co-host, again, Unruly Rev. Welcome, Rev. You can find us real quick, do my housekeeping notes, on the Interracial John website. That's J-A-W-N. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, just about anywhere you can get your podcast. But Unruly Rev, how you doing? Welcome.
Hey, how you doing there, Very White Guy?
You can call me Drew. I go by Drew. It's all right. It's been a couple of weeks. It's been a month since we did an episode right after the election. Right,
that was our hot take on the election the next morning. Yeah,
and then I left town. I went on vacation, and you've been busy, but I'm glad to catch up and kind of get back to chatting with you. Love hearing your voice, speaking with you. So thank you. And this week we're going to talk, I guess, about Pantsuit Nation, Safety Pin Box, Justice Work, some workshops I saw, and then the Delta flight this morning. Adam Salah was on, and then some implicit bias and some other topics. But so I guess I'll just, full disclosure, Leslie Mack is my wife. I'm biased with Safety Pin Box. And rather than talk about that work or the project or the business, rather, I would say, folks, check it out. Safety Pin Box. It's for white folks and allies that are looking to do better, learn a little bit more, and not bug black folks as much in the process. And it supports black liberation work and black women specifically. So, Rev, what I wanted to talk about was, so I've seen sort of the Safety Pin Box from its genesis, right? The two ladies, Marissa and Leslie, talking about it and sort of the thought and how it kind of came to be. But I'm more wanting to talk about the reaction to it, you know? And I'm again, I'm biased. I'm, full disclosure, it's my wife, so I'm going to have an opinion that's maybe a little bit different. But I do think the reaction to it caught me off guard. Just the vitriol and the disdain and the hate, almost instantaneously, you know, like literally instantaneously. And of course it's, you know, anti-black and misogynistic. And then there's a segment of folks that literally hate Marissa and blame her for, and if folks don't know, one of the co-founders of the Safety Pin Box, Leslie's business partner, is one of the young women that interrupted Bernie Sanders on, in Seattle, way back when during the primaries, and got a lot of flack for it. Like, you know, her tombstone will probably say interrupted Bernie fucking Sanders, you know, and people literally think we have Trump because Bernie lost the primary and so forth and so on. So it caught me off guard. The unmitigated gall that people had, the hate that they threw at Marissa and Leslie for it. What did you think? Were you expecting it like that?
I was not expecting the volume, both in number and I think in like loudness volume, that was going to be a part of it. And also just the different directions that it came from. It came from a variety of directions as well. And some of it was, I got involved in at least one little altercation, but, you know, Twitter moment with somebody that I think was really concerned trolling. And, you know, got some slap back and I jumped into it. And then they decided to, you know, do a thread and memorialize it and
not always
target
that
me in that. And it's just, you know, it's kind of silly when this is such a simple response and an easy response to requests that white people have had, which is tell us what to do. We don't know what to do. And so this is a really great, easy response to, especially for folks, for white folks that want to have some kind of accountability and are at least paying attention enough to know, hey, I know I want to do something. And I also am learning that I shouldn't just be doing whatever I think is right. I should be doing something to either dismantle supremacy or look at anti-blackness, look at my own racism, look at privilege. And I need to do that being led by people of color. But how do I do that when I'm not just bugging the hell out of them?
Right.
So that request has been out there. This is a great response to that and a responsible response to that.
Yeah, but people seem really kind of like in their feels that there's money attached to it, right? There's so many, and to watch, again, I'm biased, but I was here in the very beginning, and from every step I've watched and been proud and just seen everything. So in real time, from the announcement, the Facebook event, and then, you know, people sort of subscribing, and then kind of this whole stuff, right, that came from it. It was like a master class or a case study in anti-black and misogyny, and just, you know, and like you said, it came in so many forms. And the things that I know about, but I hadn't seen play out in real time, you know, with someone I love, but was just so, to me, just caught me off guard. That's my privilege. I don't have to deal with that kind of shit ever really, much less to the extent that Marissa and Leslie had to. But the moving of goalposts, the, you know, first it was, oh, you're not a 501c, and then it was, oh, but what are you going to do with the money? And then it was, oh, it costs money, and it's ostracizing the poor, and oh, it's capitalistic, and oh, you know, Marissa once said something about Sarah Palin 10 years ago. And it's just like, it was like over and over and over again, it would just constantly change. And for me, again, it was like, man, the whole spectrum. And that actually was like, this must be something needed and good, since so many people shit on it, like all the way across the board. Like I was trying to explain to my mom, like, I just, you don't get it. Like the people on the right are just really pissed. They call this like, penance for white guilt. Like literally that's what they think. Or like some people were tweeting like, oh, if you pay safety bin box, now you can say the N-word, and like making jokes about it. Like, you know, it was really ridiculous. Then in the middle, it was like you said, like, well, I just, you know, how come it's not a 501c? Well, 'cause it's 2 days old. Like it just, and maybe that's not the thing to do. And have you thought about, like, you know, like, I don't know. No, I'm not trying to throw shade at like Susan B. Komen or some of these other 501c's, but like, you know, 92% of their money goes to raising more money.
Let's talk about that.
But people were really pissed that it wasn't a 501c. Like, they're really like, I just have concerns and I wish it was like this. And, ah, man, even there was one that was like the tone, like the defense that one of the founders is making, makes me skeptical. They're defending it too much. Like, there was another one that said, oh, I see that an insert to black celebrity activist names. I wouldn't say celebrity, but insert two black activist names. I see those people that follow one of the founders. They haven't said anything, you know, so I don't know what I think about it. And it was just like, is that the criteria?
Wow. Rather than, as Elon James White always says, you could just say nothing.
Yeah, shutting up, you know. And Leslie and Mercy, like, sorry, but let me be the first to tell you, this isn't for everybody.
Right? Yeah. So if it's not, this is not your bag, or in your Philadelphia language, if this ain't your John, like, you could just say nothing. You could just say nothing. And there's so many more things to look at on the internet. Like, go by and do the other thing, walk right on by and do the other stuff that does you, and just let this be for the people who, like I said, have been asking for this. This is like a godsend for people that really want to do this kind of work in this way and be accountable in certain ways, have some kind of community around it. This is going to be great for those folks.
Yeah. And I don't want to, you know, the risk of having this podcast be a commercial for Leslie's business. And I do think it could be. That's a valuable use of the time.
I'm okay with that, actually. Yeah, me too. I'm okay with that. I think it's worth it.
Independent of that, I think the best, you know, like you said, Elon's always saying shutting up is free. It's always an option, being quiet. But go to the website, Safety Bin Box, and sign up to the newsletter and get the sample task. And they're going to have a sample task every month for free for those that are saying, oh, what about the poor? And this is inaccessible. And I'm not saying that, you know, we'll talk in a little bit more in depth about this thing about monetization. But there is free content, you know. There's absolutely free content. And I personally found the sample task for the first month you know, I have a good lens for race. I'm married to a black liberation organizer, and I still was like, ooh, man, I guess I got to go back to the drawing board and kind of think about a few things. You know, like the exercise was valuable to me. So I would say, folks, if you're questioning it, just go, you know, sign up. That's free. Get the sample task. And if it's not for you, if you're more advanced, you don't need that kind of work, or you're not there in terms of your consistency and desire for transformation, right? Stepping up in a consistent way. If you're not there, that's okay. You know, when you get there is the right time. And if you're not there, that's okay. You know, get the sample task for free. Check it out. You don't have to crap on it. But speaking of crapping on, and we'll segue into Pantsuit Nation. And right. I don't know how, have you been real dialed into what's going on with the group?
I have not. Somebody actually put me, man, one of my new pet peeves is getting put on lists without my consent. I'm just now trying to figure out how to get off. I didn't realize how many lists I'd been put on in Twitter. And so now I'm trying to figure out how to get off of them. And somebody early on put me on that for Facebook. And I don't use Facebook that way. I'm careful. I don't like things. Like, I'm very careful about how I use it to get in their algorithms. So I actually took myself out of that group a while ago. Not because of any reason other than I don't like getting put in groups that I don't choose to be in.
Right.
So I didn't follow it so closely, but now watching what some of the things that have turned into as a result, really, of Safety Pin Box and what happened with that, and now with this new revelation today with the book deal, and another article I read this morning about this, yeah, it's problematic.
It's an interesting juxtaposition to two black women starting Safety Pin Box, right? You know, I mean, like, and you know, so Twitter pro tip, to get out of a list on Twitter, you got to block the person who made the list. And on Facebook, there is a setting that says you can't be added. And I would just say generally for people, and especially for white people, don't be adding folks to lists. Especially don't be adding people of color to lists. Don't do that to black folk. Don't just like, yeah, oh, hey, join the, you know, hey, black person I think I might, you know, randomly know, let me add you to this list where you're going to expose to some fuckery and trauma. But so don't do that. But so Pantsuit Nation, like you, Leslie got added to it. A bunch of people got added to it. Like, oh, you know, join the thing. And as best I know, is it started before the election as sort of like a, you know, an HRC kind of like support group, and like, hey, we're going to be all, you know, open supporters for Hillary and unabashedly for Hillary in a safe kind of space so that trolls and, you know, the right wing don't come after us. And after the election, obviously things changed quite a bit. And there was a little bit of a, again, I this is secondhand information, I'm not in the group, but I, as I understand, turned into kind of like a liberal kind of tear fest, you know, like, oh my God, Trump, and what are we gonna do, like, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like,
sure.
A lot of us did that. I put myself in the camp. I had a, you know, I took a day or two to wallow and be all in my feels about it and shit.
Sure. And having a place to do it where that's not on Twitter, that's not going to be open to everybody to be able to see, like, you know, cocoon a little bit, lick the wounds, and then figure out maybe what to do next, hopefully.
Yeah, and but so they got like 5 million people in this group. They got like, I guess, press and big. They got a lot of folks quickly, somehow, virally, I guess. And, you know, I I'm not trying to like spill beans, but I hear Leslie's side of the conversation with some press and with Marissa, and she talks a lot about, with Safety Pin Box, her job is doing things differently with Marissa. Right. And I've heard her say, like, well, if we were a bunch of white guys, right, like if we were running this like two white dudes, well, we'd fucking do things very differently. It'd be, you know, the accusations of like, oh, you're going to make all this money and buy a car and do it, like, A, that's unfounded. But like, that's what the white people would do. Right. Like, they're assuming that two black women are going to do something that two white people would do. And I think Pantsuit Nation is what white people would do. You get 5 million people and it's like, ooh, I have kind of a brand. There's something. I'm the moderator of the group. I came up with the name. So what am I going to do? I'm going to trademark it. And they did that right away. Did that right away. And then, so, hey, would you put something about Safety Pin Box in there? Would you, nope, you can't do that. They literally banned Safety Pin Box and then put a little line, no marketing. And then right beneath that, visit our store and buy Pantsuit Nation, you know, cups and mugs and shit. So that was like a week ago. Then shortly thereafter, the trademark, they went to their local groups and said, you can no longer do activism. You can no longer do politics because we're going to be forming a 501c. Everyone wanted Safety Pin Box to be a 501c. So Safety Pin Box is now going to be a 501c. That's what they're going to see. And because of that, you can't.
No, wait, no. Pantsuit Nation is going to be a
501c. And because of that, you can't do any activism work whatsoever. So that was like, geez, what are you doing with this? This is bizarre. And then today, coup de grace, a book deal. Friggin' book deal. And I just, you know, Did the people that were in this group know that a book was going to be made? Do they have their permission for a book made? Are they going to get compensated? So it's just intriguing to me that and I'm going to ostensibly say a white woman. I know it's a woman behind Pantsuit Nation, and I'm going to just go ahead and say she's white. All indications are that she's white presenting, certainly white acting. But so she forms this group. It's like a good idea. It gets kind of big without any real effort on her part. And what does she do? Locks it up, trademark, 501c, monetize, sell a bunch of shit, now got a book deal. And Leslie and Marissa got so much fucking shit for Safety Pin Box. Yeah. It's just like,
well, because my question, and I don't know, I haven't looked in the depths of Pantsuit Nation, so usually a 501c3 is created because there's something to do, because there's some goal, because there's a non-profit problem that we're going to solve, or, you know, some problem, some issue, something we're going to do, and we're using the status of nonprofit because of the way it's structured. We're not going in here to make money on it. We're going in here to help change something. That's usually why a not-for-profit is started, because it's not an easy thing to do. It's a pain in the neck to go through. It's a legal process to do. So normally, so my question is, so what's the big issue that people are upset? Like, I'm not sure what the thing to solve is.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the thing was that they knew if it was a for-profit business, people would come for them. They had to be a 501c, or it would be a complete, the same thing that's happening to Leslie and Marissa would happen to them. They didn't want that.
Ding, 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 ding. Yeah, I think you might have hit something there.
Right, and this is another interesting sort of like tangential side note. They, as a business, because they now are an LLC, they've formed a business, that's what you do. It was kind of eerie that as a business, they've got some protections that they don't have as people. Literally.
Oh, yeah.
Like, think about that. Like, corporations are people, right?
Yep.
And, like, you can say all kinds of horrible stuff about Marissa and Leslie all day long. There's nothing they can do. You can, you know, almost death threats and rape threats, all kinds of shit all day long. Nobody can do anything. Hurl, you know, the worst of epithets possible and nothing. Say those things about a business and there's like actual like ramifications and recourse. Is that factual? Is it libelous? Is it, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's things that the business, you know, because it's a business, it, like, I don't want to say legitimizes, that's the wrong word, but it literally gives business,
there's protection.
Yeah, businesses have protection. We, as a society, we protect businesses in a way we don't protect black women, and that's fucking just awful.
Yeah,
that they're getting benefits and being a business that they didn't get as citizens, as black women in our country. But so I guess another segue. Pantsuit Nation, what are they doing? I don't know. That's a good question. We'll leave it up there. Maybe somebody can. They can tell us their what their 501c mission is, other than soaking up white tears after the election. I don't know. But so I saw this workshop, Healing Toxic Whiteness, and this all falls under this sort of monetization. And there's I struggle with this. If you're doing justice work, you've got to be a pauper, right? It's like if you're an artist and you're poor and living on the street and you're destitute, people think you're amazing. And as soon as you sell something for $1 million, you're a sellout, right? It's kind of weird that's how we view art and justice and other sort of careers and things. But so there is this vein of like, if you're making money, you can't possibly be doing good. And if you're doing good, you shouldn't be making money. And I think that's, I don't really ascribe to that. Like, that doesn't fit in with the reality that we live in a world in which you've got to make money. Like, you know, like you can be an anti-capitalist, but like, it's still a capitalistic society. You still got to eat and breathe and have a roof over your head. Right. So there is this thing where it's like, you know, I don't know, like making money, I'm not sure. It's kind of weird. So now I'm struggling. This is a conversation I like to have with you as a white person, and I am biased. So I'm, you know, I've had this conversation with you privately about, so you and I are going to do a workshop. We're going to do some work together. Our faith, the Unitarian Universe, has accepted us to do a workshop. And I have.
Now, let's be clear. Wait, before we say that, they're not paying us to do that, because that's part of our donation to
Correct.
Our faith, at
Correct.
Least in the at the General Assembly. Piece.
Correct.
Yeah.
But so as we were talking about you and I doing this work and other things, you and I had a discussion that, you know, my privilege is such that I seek to make anything I do widely accessible and as free as possible. But that's my privilege. That's me, Drew. I have that ability. But in leveraging that, I might be harming, say, someone like you I'm working with, right? Like my colleague or partner in this. Or I might be undermining the inherent value that should be ascribed to educating people in this way, right? Like just because I can do it for free, just because I want these resources to be free, doesn't mean that if it's not, it's bad, right? But so I personally have not, you know, especially when it comes to white people talking to other white people, I don't really like things that are paid. I've had like a knee jerk sort of like eschewing. I don't amplify and retweet stuff. But so there was a workshop that a friend of mine, Dara, used to be with Surge, and I was doing some voter work. And I think it was Everyday Feminism put it on, and it was sort of like a live stream web kind of event, a couple of hours on an evening, and it was really good content. I'm not gonna lie, it was really appropriate and valuable, and I think it was good for white folk. And they had non-black people of color. They had, you know, a wide, diverse group of folks, you know, across the spectrum in this live free workshop. They have since come out with a 10-week online sort of self-study, multiple sessions, multiple videos, like, you know, lots and lots and hours of content, things that probably required money and time and effort to put together, things that on a hosting basis, bandwidth and infrastructure. So they're selling it, they're charging for it. And it's, again, I think it's kind of a good price, $97, $100. That doesn't seem like a lot of money.
Oh, no, not for a 10 week yeah, piece. That's yeah. reasonable.
But yeah. So I have this weird kind of like, I don't know, like I struggle, like it's weird. Right. And I don't know if that's because of my wife and I'm biased. So, and she's, you know, I've been listening to her have this conversation with trolls and media and, you know, other people. So I understand her position, and I respect and appreciate it, and I actually agree with it. But then I still have this weird kind of like, geez, I wish Everyday Feminism didn't charge $100 for that. You know what I mean? It's like, it's a bizarre, I almost feel hypocritical thinking that, but I still think that way.
Well, there's class stuff that's involved in this too, right? And you said, like you said, there's privilege because the people working on that need to eat. The other thing that I think is important for this too is at least culturally, certainly within white culture, I think I don't believe in white culture in the United States of America. I don't believe that we value things that we don't pay for. So one thing that I've learned in doing workshops and other kinds of and trainings and other spheres over the last 15 years or so is when I have offered free workshops, folks will come and sign up, and then half of the people don't show up.
Mm.
If we charge even $50, the people that sign up show up, and they get something different out of it because we ascribe that we value things monetarily.
Yeah.
And so if something costs, then it's worth something, and it's also I'm more likely to show up and attend, follow up. You know, so I think there is something to be said for that culturally. That's how we value and we take care of people. We take care of ourselves. There's just a way of looking at things that value is connected to money for white American, United States of American kind of culture. So even if it's a little bit, I think there's more of a commitment because, hey, listen, I put my money down. You know, I put my money down, I'm going to show up to it, and then we'll see what happens from there. There's something to that. And I think also having white people pay, it does take something then out of our pockets. It's requiring us to commit our resources to something and not just get it for free. I think that's important. If it's to the other piece around this that I hear you too, and I agree with you on, because I'm a little squeamish about where we're as a white person, where I'm putting my money. I would prefer to hand it to people of color especially around certain issues around race, around a lot of different issues. If there's an expert, let's go see if we can find a non-white perspective on it and hand money over there. There's also times when I think that white people are whatever threshold may be more willing and able and comfortable with doing work with white speakers, with white workshop leaders, you know, doing some of that caucusing work. And so then for me, if I'm going to be connected to a white person that's leading that kind of work. And there are legitimate people that do really good work that way and help open eyes and really get people to go deeper, other white people to go deeper. So then my question is going to be, if I'm going to, you know, hand you $1,500, let's say, is that all going into your pocket? Are you also giving, kind of tithing, you know, 10% somewhere else? Are you supporting other movements, people of color or the movement some way, somewhere, so that, you know, as a white person, you're not just gaining even more from being the white person doing the work?
Yeah. And that's maybe where sometimes I don't say I struggle, but like white people paying other white people to learn about racism is just like viscerally kind of like that kind of like I struggle with that. And I don't want to call it like the Tim Wise effect, but you know what I mean? Like, you know, someone but at the same time, there's this kind of like reality, like you said, that perhaps white cis het male voices are being heard more by other people. But is that a good thing? Is that, you know, is that really appropriate? Is that modeling the right behavior? Or is that just getting the message across, you know, any way you can? And then I also feel like the healing from toxic whiteness as a topic, it's like you and I have had this discussion. I've tweeted a little bit about this. I don't talk about racism and white supremacy. I'm not an expert on that. People of color, people at the intersections are. But I think I'm pretty versed about being a white person that's indoctrinated and moving to, you know, less messed up views, right? Like I think I'm pretty good at detailing that. And I think white people are kind of the only ones that can really detail that. Like, again, let's be real that supremacy indoctrinates everybody, and black folk can have internalized depression, and their journey in dealing with that, I know nothing about and I don't talk about, and, you know, right, ask my wife, and they're the experts on that. But other white folk navigating this journey, I think white people are the ones to kind of be the person kind of talking about how to do that healing from toxic whiteness. So on the one hand, it's like, yeah, I think white people are kind of the right folk for this. But then, like you, it's like, ugh, is it just white people paying white people to like learn? You know, like the question maybe is not only what does the money go to and who does it go to and what does it do, but what do you do? What do you expect people to do at the end of this quote unquote workshop? If all it is have a better understanding, you know more and be able to talk more, you know, like, yeah. I guess that's needed or good, but that to me isn't an effective change agent. You know,
it's real. Well, that's really a first tier, first level of folks that have not even thought about this before. There's got to be an entry point somewhere. We watched this happen last summer at our General Assembly, where we wound up in caucusing groups, right? So we started out kind of together as a larger work group at one of the workshops, and then separated into a black group, a non-black people of color group, and then a white group. And people self-selected into those groups to be able to go deeper, because there are some conversations that happen more likely, maybe not even easier, but may feel like it's a safer space in those caucusing groups. And that can be really powerful and needed. So I think the danger that both of us feel is if it turns into everything is one way or everything's another. And that's one thing that we can't do, is put a blanket over all of it and say that it's all the same and it's all okay.
Yeah. Here's an interesting, as we're talking about this, it's coming to mind. There was an individual who spent, I don't know, like 20 years working with KKK members, right? Just like, you know, deep, intense one-on-one work with KKK guys. And, you know, maybe like removed a dozen or 20 from, you know, KKK life after, you know, many, many, many years, a decade. There's a group called Exit USA of former skinheads, former hate group members that do intensive peer counseling to help people exit hate ideology and hate groups. And it's like, man, that's needed. I get it. Like, I absolutely understand that's like these folks are probably out there doing harm. And if they want to leave the group, there should be some resources. And as we've discussed, the kind of logical best only folk to really do that are people that have experience in navigating that themselves. But then I start thinking, like, well, is that really the most effective use of resources and time? Like, when the election happened, everyone starts going on about, we got to talk to our crazy racist Uncle Kevin. And it's like, But is that really like, why is that where we go? Like, and I think it's this binary good, bad, racist thing where we want to like solve systemic racism by like eliminating the most racist person we know. But that's like really ineffective. Like KKK folks, like they've lost a seat at the table. They don't need to be unindoctrinated. And like the Exit USA group, again, no disrespect to them. I wonder, someone who exits hate ideology, what are they going to do? Are they going to be a real effective agent for change? And this is a point Leslie brought up that her lens is so good I hadn't thought of. It's like the person who used to be in the hate group who now is helping other people get out of the hate group. So you were an oppressor. You did some horrible stuff and you want to make amends. You want to do better by helping more of the oppressors not be oppressors. Like, it's weird. Like, you'd think the focus would be on the people you harmed, not more people that are harming those people. But I don't know.
And I don't know what other things that they may be doing, because that may be some other part of it too. I don't know. I would say that there is, if that's where those people, listen, there's more than enough work to go around, right? So if one guy is spending 20 years and he's getting a dozen, two dozen folks out, the thing that's positive about that is that those dozen, two dozen people, if they're having kids, if they've got other, like, there can be generational changes or opportunities for shifts that go beyond the scope of that one individual, right? Mm. More lives can be changed, which is positive in the bigger, longer term scale. And if that's what those folks are good and committed to, for me, I'm not going to argue with them about that being useful for them. I don't know if that's all they're doing. I would hope that they're doing more, you know, like you said, to also look at other kinds of amends that can be made. I agree with you on that in terms of turning like all of our resources to turning KKK members around or skinheads around. That would not be a good use of all of our resources. But for the people that know how to do that, that have been a part of it, I think you're right too, right on the head around peers, right? They were already part of it, and so they have a different voice to be able to go in and work with people, just like, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics have a different voice than people on the outside going, come on, you shouldn't drink, is very different than, man, I almost died as a result of this. There's a way out if you want it.
And you've made a good point. I should not cast aspersions, even if, so I'll admit this, that wouldn't be my ministry. That's just not something that I would see use of my time, but I should not cast aspersions on how anyone chooses to really, you know, like you said, it's going to take a lot of us pulling in many, many different directions. And I don't know what else folks are doing, but I do think there is something there with this, because there was a collective, like after the trumpeting of like, let's talk to the most racist people in our family. And it was like, why is that the direction, like the default, like, let's do that. Like, is it the easiest? Probably. Is it the most likely to have zero impact? Maybe. I don't know.
Well, I think now it depends on also what you're doing. I can see, yeah, if I'm going to my most racist relative, of which I have several, if my goal is to turn them around, that's, you know, the likelihood of that, depending on their age and where they are and what they're doing, is probably really unlikely. Now, the difference being if I tend to be quiet around them and let their voice be the loudest at family gatherings, and me not choosing to kind of succumb to that any longer and let that be the only voice that comes out, now that's a different story. And I think there's also modeling, again, that goes on for my kids, for my nieces and nephews that might happen to be there. That's a different way to think about it. It's different if I'm trying to, do you see what I mean? Like, if I'm trying to change them, well, I don't know that that's going to happen. But if I'm not going to be quiet anymore and let them be the only voice, that's a different angle on it. And if I'm going to step up to that and challenge that, I think that's also different. And different people may be doing different things too.
I was thinking more, not individual cases like that, but there was just a collective, like, you know, let's go talk to the most racist of us. Like, white people, we need to do our work. And it's like, well, but the work should be shifting power and resources to marginalized communities and talking to your most racist Uncle Kevin. How does that do that? And you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, and again, I'm not saying that be quiet, don't do this. Not at all. I just, there was a collective, like an urgency, like, you know, like November, yeah, like 10th, like, oh my God, we got to talk to the most racist among us right away. Even the, like, we got to reach across the board and find, oh, yeah, common ground. And it's like that, you know, but again, yeah, I shouldn't cast aspersions on anyone's ministry and what they, how they choose to do things. But there's a lot intertwined in sort of all those pieces. But let's shift gears and talk about Delta. And there's some complexity, right? There's a bit here.
Yeah.
And maybe if folks don't know, why don't you just describe a little bit about the, no, I can't. So Adam Salazza, he's a video logger.
I only looked through it. Like I only could bear to watch it once. So,
okay. So, Adam Salazza is a video blogger and, you know, I would say, you know, Middle Eastern presenting, brown, you know, person of color presenting, if you will, and, was on a plane and, apparently was speaking Arabic to a colleague and maybe on the phone to a mother. And, then was removed from the plane. And so make it clear, periscoped while on the plane, security came, removed him. Delta admits that there was an incident and they removed him from the plane. There were people on the plane that literally cheered Adam's departure, you know, said goodbye and gave him the finger and good riddance kind of stuff. And afterwards at the gate, they called the police. He had to, like, you know, talk to a bunch of folks. It was many hours before he was on another plane and eventually on his way. So the complication or the wrinkle is that Adam has at a previous point, as I said, as a video logger, you know, had some pranks and video kind of things to get viability and views, including maybe pretending that he got on a plane in a suitcase and, you know, boarded and went across the, you know, from Sydney to somewhere else in a plane that didn't really happen. And the airline had footage of him actually boarding the plane. They kind of debunked this video that he put out. And then there was one that I don't know as much about, but it was a viral video with reactions of folks that was demonstrating, I would say, Islamophobia. I think it was reading passages from something. I can't remember what the video was, but he is at another juncture admitted that, okay, I staged some of that, like to get the sort of reactions. And, you know, someone hit me with that right away. And I said, listen, I that doesn't negate what happened and transpired on the Delta plane. That doesn't change anything at all about the employees and all the white people on the plane. I don't know if there was or wasn't anything that was quote unquote staged, but it doesn't change anything. All it does is give a bunch of other folks a reason to negate Adam's encounter, right? It gives a lot of folks an easy leverage to say, nope, this didn't happen. It's not real. Don't, you know, you don't have to pay attention to this. Ignore it because he once was a prankster. And even, like, let's just hypothetically say, worst case scenario, there was some deliberate instigation on Adam's part. I don't think that, but let's just hypothetically pretend that that actually is the case. How does that fucking change the way Delta responded? How does that change the way the white people on that plane responded? You know, yeah, it doesn't change anything. Feminista Jones had a good thread about this and made a good analogy about John Quinones and the What Would You Do? Right. Like, that's what that whole show is. Like, they stage shit with actors and they set stuff up and nobody gripes about that. They talk about the reaction. They talk about, ooh, that person was friggin' racist in that response. And again, I don't think Adam, right now, as best I can tell, Adam is not saying he staged anything and Delta is not saying he staged anything. If he staged something, you'd friggin' sure as hell believe Delta would be on the front with that, you know, public and loud, right? Delta's admitting that they messed up taking him off the plane. So until somebody says, hey, you know, he did this, he did that, blah, 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 I have no reason, no one should have any reason to doubt what transpired. But yeah, it was hard watching.
Oh yeah. Well, and as a lot of people have commented, at least some of the Twitter stuff I'm looking at, the way Delta acted is one thing, but also the way a whole lot of white people on that airplane reacted is also something to look at. And really what I should say is the way the white people didn't respond. Right. So they're, for all the, and kind of where safety pin box got its name, right? Right after the election, we're gonna wear safety pins to show that we have got Muslims and immigrants and black people and LGBTQ folks will wear safety pins so that those folks know that we've got their backs. And I'm not the first one to notice, you know, like I said, a lot of people noticed. So did, if you were any of those people that were silent on the airplane watching this these two young men get escorted off the airplane, did they have safety pins on their jacket? And if so, where is the backup that you are about to have?
And there was, I think, one individual that stood up, and I'm not trying to, you know, say who is this or that, but didn't seem white presenting. The person that was defending Adam seemed like a person of color as well. And you're absolutely right about the silence, right? This, the bystander effect, this tacit approval that I call it poof of racism, right? Poof of racism happens and people are like, and then they get real quiet and there's this like Schrodinger's cat, like, you know, is it, are there more racists or more justice folk in this room? What's the temperature? And then they're going to decide, am I going to respond this way or that way? And this was just awful that people just stood there. And he's like, Adam was on the verge of tears, right? Like, I don't mean that in a disrespectful way, but just the, the indignity, you know, like the Black Death is horrible and traumatic. And I'm not saying that this is worse, but something about the indignities in this just really bothered me. And because I see my wife traveling and, you know, TSA is touching her hair and all this shit. But I really instantly remembered the fucking white dude on another Delta flight yelling, Trump, Trump, Trump. I got some Hillary bitches. Listen, he got banned for life. But you know what he didn't get? Kicked off that plane.
Yeah, he made it to his destination. He made it.
They didn't stop that flight at all. And
he would not have gotten banned for life had that not gone viral the way it did.
Yeah.
So let's be really clear about that. If nobody had ever seen it, he wouldn't have gotten banned for life. And if these kids did not get, if that, they were getting kicked off whether anybody saw it or not.
Yeah, and Adam's got a, because he is a video blogger and he's got a bit of a platform, he's got the verified blue check and hundreds of thousands of followers. So this incident that he periscoped live this morning at like, you know, 7 a.m. or something, it received a level of attention because he has a voice and a platform that not every Muslim person kicked off a plane has. Right. Not every person speaking Arabic on a plane has the ability to get a response like this. So I don't know what's got to change, but man, these airlines and this coddling of just like white irrational fear and white fragility, it's getting people killed. It's just, you know, when are we going to, on a plane, just say, you know what, sit the fuck down and stop being a fucking whiny white fucking whatever, you know? Good Lord. And it's like, I don't understand the fear is like, what is the thought process when someone's speaking a foreign language in a plane? They went through security just like you fucking did. Like, have you been through security these days? They fucking search this shit. Like, they got the microwave fucking thing. They got the, I mean, good Lord. Like, what do you really fucking think is going to happen? Really?
Well, and again, going back to the white people that didn't say, hey, what's the problem here? What's the concern? What's the complaint? Is this just because they're speaking Arabic? How many other languages are spoken here? I'm wondering about all those people that didn't say anything, that just didn't say anything, and that's hundreds of, you know, that's got to be what, a couple hundred people on that airplane. Yeah, yeah. And there had to have been a bunch of people on there that probably were not okay with what was happening, how public it was, what was going on, and yet didn't say anything. And what are they afraid of? Are they afraid of, hey, what if I get kicked off too? It's more important. I really need to get home to see my family. I really need to get to, you know, my job is happening, or whatever it is. All of those things. I mean, I think that's the thing, you know, part of what we have to talk about as white people, and this idea, here we are in the White Privilege Podcast, is this idea that we have to start giving some things up, and that we're going to start losing some of that privilege. And maybe it is that, you know what, I'm going to miss this airplane because I'm not okay with this, and I'm going to walk off this airplane with them.
Yeah.
And I'm going to lose that money. Some of us have the ability to lose some of that money. Some of us don't have it, but like, really, when it comes down to it, if we're going to dismantle this system of supremacy and privilege that we stand on, it means we're going to lose some things too. And what I saw by nobody saying anything is that they weren't willing to lose anything, including just being embarrassed. They were not willing to lose their dignity, right, by maybe being embarrassed, by standing up and saying, I'm not okay with this. What's going on? Not to come in as a hero, right, or a savior to come in and save the day, but just to stand up and witness in real solidarity means they would have lost something. And nobody, none of the white folks there were willing to actually stand up and do it. And I have to say, like, I can understand that. That's a hard thing to do, right? That's some of what, why the safety pin is for me, not something that I'm wearing, because it's easy. It really is, as other people have said, like the least thing that we could do, because it doesn't require anything. It doesn't cost anything for me. If I'm going to, what I need to do is actually do what that safety pin implies, which is actually stand up, move forward, do something, speak up, give up some stuff.
And I think that's our job as white people. And I wouldn't say the purpose of this podcast, but the thing that I know you and I work on constantly is the internal work as a white person in a white supremacist society to be in a position to stand up at that moment. That's the job. Yeah. That's the task for white people, is to do the work internally so that when presented with that poof of racism, you do stand up. Like there is risk. The risk is real. And in this instance, you're right. Maybe it was missing a flight. Maybe you didn't get to home on time. Maybe you had to spend more money. I don't know what the risk would have been, but I can tell you what would it have looked like if when they were getting, if Adam and I think it was Slim's friend getting kicked off that flight, if a dozen white people stood up and just said, you know what, this is not acceptable. This is unacceptable to me. If they go, we go. That would have been a real different fucking video. What a real different message. White, and that bystander effect goes all the way up. I remember reading about it with Kitty Genovese in New York. A woman in the 60s was stabbed and brutally beaten, and the killer left her for dead and then came back hours later and ended up finishing the job. All the while, multiple neighbors heard her cries for help and never called the police or went down to check on her. Everyone thinking someone else or this or that. It's not my problem, you know. So that effect is real, and it only takes one person. Just one person. And all you really got to do is say, that's not acceptable to me. And that doesn't even put it on the other person. You're just saying, that is not acceptable to me. Nobody can fucking get issue with that. They can say anything they want, and you can stand by that. You can repeat it. Call me what you want. That's still not acceptable to me. That's it.
Yep.
And other people would jump in, you know?
Yeah. But it's, I think this in some ways goes a little bit back to some of the things that we talked about on the last episode, around for white people, kind of the some stages here, this awareness, acceptance, and then action. And some of the internal work that I know that I need to do and that we've talked about is the first thing I have to do is be aware that a situation's going on around me. And that's one of the things that a lot of white people aren't, is even aware that there's a situation going on, because we're not required to be aware of that. We can get right through life without paying attention to this stuff going on.
I said blissfully oblivious.
Blissfully oblivious. So that awareness is the first kind of piece around that. And then I think that the acceptance part, right? Okay, it is happening. What am I going to do about it? That risk, am I willing to? There's another piece. There's pieces around that. And then, but only when you're aware of it, then can you really take action. So
absolutely.
I think for those of us that are learning how to do it, this is a muscle that we have to start working on. And when we work on it, then we've got a chance, right, at maybe being able to take some of that action. Because if we don't know what else we would do, if we haven't thought about it, if we weren't aware of it, then we're not going to be able to be the one person or one of the 12 people that stand up and say, hey, not okay. You can't, no.
Yeah. And, you know, you said about acceptance and action and the different sort of steps and stages people go through. I completely agree. And that the muscle analogy, I think, is perfect. It's like we've atrophied that muscle. You know what I mean? Like there's actual science that shows that white people have a empathy gap with black folk, with like you show pictures of white people and black people, and like, you know, it's like literally an empathy gap, right? So this indoctrination, this conditioning, it's atrophied a muscle. And when you're oblivious and you don't even know that shit's happening, the muscle's really dead. You know, like first you get the awareness, like, oh, wait a minute, this is actually something. Like I get it now. And then you're kind of like accepting, like, oh, this is really real. Like, Jesus, this is really real. And you might feel apathetic and guilty, but that muscle is still untrained, you know, until you get active, you start doing things. And I'll just speak in my own life. Like, you know, I haven't spoke up every time I had an opportunity to, you know, I haven't said my piece at every instance I think I could. Hindsight's 20/20. But I know this. I know that the times I failed to speak up, they bothered me. They bothered me enough that I made sure the next time I didn't fail. And that the more I made sure I didn't fail, the easier it was to not fail, right? Like, that muscle got better and stronger. And, like, again, I can't speak for anyone other than me. When shit like that happens in my brain, it used to be this, like, instant cavalcade of equivocation. They didn't mean it like that. They didn't, you know, it wasn't like this. I know them. Oh, they're really a good person. They, you know, you're just being sensitive. That, you know, all these things I would do just in like the flash before your eyes in an instant, all this shit would hit my brain. And that's conditioning. Like, I didn't actually, that's not me thinking those things. That's me living in a world that tells me to think those things for the last 40 fucking years. And so in the beginning, going back a ways, that equivocation sort of like wheel would be spinning in my brain for a good period of time before I'd be like, wait a minute, what that person said was really racist and fuck up. I can't be sitting here equivocating that. I got to speak, you know, truth to that. Like, what the hell? So the process of, in fact, it's like a literal awareness in my own brain that I need to speak up and that this is the time to speak up and here's how, and this is the words and the language. That process, it still exists. I've just shortened it down to the point that I can actually react. Like, I still have the equivocation. My immediate thought when racism shit happens is they didn't mean it like that. You know what I mean? Like, I still have that. Like, it still happens. That's white fragility or whatever it is. It's conditioning. But so my skill, the thing that I'm trying to do is keep using that muscle so that when that happens, I'm still going to have that ridiculous equivocation response, but I'm gonna nip it in the bud and I'm gonna react differently. I'm gonna act differently, but not until I've been aware and working on it. And that muscle's been dead for a long time.
Right. Well, and to kind of keep going with that analogy that we've just been talking with muscles. So when you first start working out a muscle, man, it hurts. It hurts and you're sore afterwards and it's not comfortable and you go, why do I want to keep going to the gym, or why did I ever take that run? That was insane. I never should have done that because I can't believe I can't, you know, move my arm to brush my teeth today. So that's real, I think, as we're starting to work these muscles out too. Because so I would also maybe reset an idea of what a success and failure is in trying to step up and say things and take action, as to a success is not solving the whole problem. A success is actually just stepping up and maybe interrupting some of the speech and behavior, right?
Yeah.
If 12 people had stood up with Adam on that airplane, they would not have solved. I 100% believe that he still would have been kicked off the airplane. And the other, and so, but that's not the level. That's not what success would have looked like. Success would have been not letting it go by, and not just letting this really Islamophobic and racist behavior go unwitnessed and unobjected to.
Yeah.
So, figuring out what that win is or what the success is, you know, I have to say, I'm not good. Contrary to what people may think about me, who know me, I'm actually not great at confrontation.
I wouldn't have guessed that. I would have thought you'd been like I'm like, man, I bet Rev's good at confrontation, man.
I'm learning about how to do it, right? Because of my background, and I'm generally actually an introvert, and it's hard for me to be out and jump into things, and I tend to be a little more quiet, especially in situations with people that I don't know.
So that's
hard for me. So exercising that muscle, I also have a lag time for a lot of different reasons. Exercising that muscle, I can feel awkward, and I am awkward, and I do tend to now get into the action place where I can say things. I'm not necessarily super eloquent. It's not something I would generally want somebody to, you know, be recording and then replay later, because it won't be the most eloquent and the best thought out, whatever. So that so part of that muscle for me that's sore is, you know, my ego getting around this. And so that then becomes one of the things I think that the cost, one of the things I'm sacrificing, is feeling great about myself because, hey, I did this in the most spectacular way possible. No, I stumbled through it. My ego's got to get out of the way because this isn't about me having my ego fed. This is about doing the right thing.
Yeah, and I love this analogy and muscle and training. You know, when you're working out, you can have bad form. You know what I mean? You can lift things the wrong way. You can, you're still working out. The muscle still has some benefit. And I like this redefining the metric of success. And I've always talked and have some similar language about this being a journey, and the journey doesn't really end. You're always, at least for me as a, you know, cis identified heterosexual, you know, of Christian upbringing, white male in this world, I'll be working on my various oppressive behaviors forever, right? But in the sense of a journey, just like working out, the metric for success is, am I improving? Am I better today than I was the day before? Have I been in this? And I'm not a gym individual, but I know, and I have known quite a few people that are like bodybuilders, like they're in the gym religiously. And boy, oh boy, I can tell you the one thing they've all had in common. That's consistency. They work out rain or shine. We go on vacation and they want to know where the gym is. They, especially when they're in a competition, like a bodybuilding competition, every ounce of every water, diet, protein that goes into their body is monitored. It's at the right time. I mean, it's a process, and they
work. And a discipline.
And a discipline, a consistent discipline. Yeah. And boy, that is really where Safety Pin Box, I think, is great, and where we as white people need to get to is that consistency. And wearing a safety pin just ain't it. You know, that doesn't mean a hill of beans, you know. That's not consistent to anything. Other than
go ahead.
Other than you consistently poke holes in your clothes.
There you go. Well, another piece around that, I think going to our kind of sports analogy as well, and muscle and working out, is I think there's a lot of stuff that we as white people do that's when it's just purely education is about sitting on the sidelines, right? And watching and being an observer, right? Because we can be kind of fans and having been a fan of a couple of sports teams, like a big fan over the years, man, I know how to coach from my seat, right? Because I'm a good fan. I know the sport. I know how it should be done. I know how it should be played. And I can coach right from my seat and never get any sweat in the game. My body is not on the line. I'm not actually participating. I'm just a spectator. And I may be a really well-informed spectator, but that doesn't make me a player. And for me, in terms of dismantling white supremacy and privilege, and in all the different ways that it comes in terms of racism and heterosexism and you know, Islamophobia in terms of kind of religionism, right? All these different places, man, I want to be a participant, and that's what I'm committed to, is being a participant. I may be a terrible intramural player type participant, but I'm going to get on the court, right? And I'm going to keep doing, and the only person I'm competing against is who I was yesterday, and sometimes who I was earlier today.
Yeah, I love that. And I'll say this, I know I'm not going to name names, but I have some white, anti-racist colleagues and friends and people that in my white accountability circle. And, I've helped some friends navigate some mistakes that I think might have derailed me. You know what I mean? So get out in the game, get active, get busy. And I'm with you. I think, I don't know if it's a white thing, but a lot of people in society are just kind of on the sidelines with their own life. You know, it's just a lot easier to describe things that happened to us and in a third person sort of way, or it's a lot easier to describe like, oh, you know, I should have done this and I should have done that. And, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't do this. That's like, that's easy versus actually changing your behavior and being different and saying, ooh, I didn't do this right, and I'm going to be accountable to you. And you know what I mean? Like we don't even, like we have the, on our other podcast, the This Week in Sorries, or the apologies. I don't think we've had an apology once where someone's actually contrite, where they're actually like, okay, I'm this is my mistake and I'm going to be accountable for it. That's a rarity, you know?
Yeah. Well, and to looking then as to some of the things, and again, where's the goalposts and where's success? When we're talking about things like dismantling, you know, white supremacy, dismantling supremacy and looking at privilege, again, what is a success if it's just the idea that, well, we have to take down the whole system? The way we take, it's the idea of one step in front of you. What can you do? I mean, I'm a parent that is underemployed. with, I mean, I do have a wife, I have a co-parent, but, you know, we're in a minimal, you know, income bracket. We've got two kids. So in terms of the way that I spend my time and spend my money is different than it used to be, let's say 10 years ago, when the economy was different and when our family situation was different, and I could, I had different choices and different priorities to make. But that doesn't mean that there aren't things that I can do in my sphere, as they talk about actually in the safety pin box, the sample task, you know, my sphere of influence. What is my, which was part of the first download of that, what's my sphere of influence? For me, really briefly, it came into, in the last couple of weeks, going to a conversation that my kids' school had, their daycare that they go to. They actually hosted and have been hosting, this week, it's, or this month it turned a little differently, this was a conversation about implicit bias. Wow. And its impact on kids. So it was really looking at implicit bias and studies that have been done in preschool teachers. And we we can link to in the notes the article that was presented, and then we talked about, and we had a discussion. There were probably 10 of us in the room, parents and teachers and administrators in the school, from many different races. There were a few of us that were white. I think there were 5 of us that were white, and then there were probably, oh, maybe it was more than 10, probably 4 black women, and then 1 or 2 non-black people of color in the room, having this discussion, and we, you know, about what does implicit bias look like. So we had a conversation. We were talking about it. Just what is it? How does it play out? How is it playing out in the school where we are? The director of which is a black woman. The executive director is a white man. And they were both in the room and part of the conversation. And, you know, so one of the teachers was there, a black woman who was one of the teachers, and then another administrator, a white woman. And then, like I said, a number of us are parents. You know, I talked about how I've seen preferential treatment and preferential words spoken about my white child that's in that class or in that school, and how I've seen by teachers, and how I've seen a particular one white, you know, teacher treat other black teachers in that school. And so here's an example. So I talked about it in that room for the first time. And one of the ways, like you were talking about, kind of kicking yourself later, boy, I wish I had done better. I had that later where I'm thinking, man, why didn't I speak up when I saw it happen? And this is the incident, one incident I'm thinking of happened probably a good year and a half ago. And my muscle wasn't trained enough to be able to speak up. I noticed it at the time. And I did the same thing you did too. I came home and I spoke to my wife and I was like, man, this thing happened. This seems really messed up to me, but I'm not sure if it's messed up the way I think it is. Like, and we talked it through and we were like, oh, that was just flat out supremacy and racist nonsense. But now what do I do about it? Because it already happened. Nobody else witnessed it except for me. Like, how do I handle it now? So at the time, I didn't handle it well other than notice it and pay attention to it. And now I'm in a community, a smaller community, my school, where this opportunity arose. And I thought, okay, now's the time for me to talk about it. And my commitment then to myself and to the other people in that room is that I'm going to bring things up and I'm going to talk about them immediately now when this happens. And that was an important part of that for me, is to say, I can't, you know, I got to step up. The fact, I mean, one thing, one of the reasons that our kids are in this school, and this is the one that we, you know, do what we can to make sure that they can be here, is the fact that this school is actually willing to talk about it. And that's not the case all over the place. So that's an important beginning piece. And the next thing that I did as we were talking, you know, I said just flat out, looking the executive director, the white guy, in his eyes, and I said, so we're having a good conversation here. What are you going to do to try to get some changes happening in this school? Because the school is too important to me. It's too important to my kids, what my kids are learning here and the things that they're – it's too important. And they actually then – what was really cool is they actually then kind of talked about the things that they actually already are doing on a staff level that just have been not brought to the parents. So they're actually doing some implicit bias work with their staff that I just wasn't aware of yet. I'm so glad that they're doing it. And I hope that it becomes a bigger part of the conversation that parents are involved in and that we can be involved in as a community, because this is a place where I can start exercising those muscles and do better.
Yeah. And I would say for other parents that are listening, you know, if you're thinking, oh, you know, preschool and that's so young, not at all. You know, there's absolutely documentation. It's a empirically studied fact that, that Black children, you know, are getting put into detention. They're getting reprimanded as young as 3 and 4 at rates higher than their white peers. And that's implicit bias. That's implicit bias, you know?
And that's what this article, this NPR article, particularly that we can link to, that was the beginning of the conversation that we had at our school. It's research that was done with preschool teachers that show that that white and Black preschool teachers are looking to the Black boys to be causing the most problems, even when that's not when they actually break down who's doing the actual problems in the class. It's not that doesn't mean it's coming from that, but that's who they look to first as expecting the problems to come from.
That's that pre-K to prison pipeline, right? You know,
right there, and the
work on implicit bias is so not just important, but it's one of those areas that, like, so you talked about awareness and acceptance. So you got to be aware that you've got an implicit bias. Like, you don't know what you don't know. You got a blind spot. You got a blind spot. I think it's called the Dunning-Kruger. There's a name to it. I'll have to look it up, like Dunning-Kruger effect or something. But you don't know what you don't know. So you got to be aware of it. You know, that's the first step. But then you got to accept it. You got to be like, wait a minute. Okay, I have this. It doesn't make me a racist. I don't hate Black people, but I have conditioning. I have thoughts and a bias by being a white person raised in a stew of white supremacy and anti-Blackness. Like, that's happened to me, not at my own. I didn't ask for it, didn't want it, and it's happened anyway. So I accept that. And now I'm going to work to counter it, right? Like, that's what you got to do. I maybe we talked about it on this show, but I literally had a workshop with 7 close friends from church, people that love me and know me. It was, you couldn't have been in a safer environment. I brought in an outside facilitator, an expert at doing these kinds of things. And the very first, like, 15 minutes in, we're setting up the tone and how things go. And first thing we do is implicit bias. And we're talking about implicit bias. And it's like, you know, raise your hand if, you know, the words you see here, you thought Black. And it was like words like criminal and, you know, all these different things. And I put my hand up, you know, yeah, that's me. I got implicit bias. That's what I thought. Nobody else did. Nobody else did. And like a person who's like a really good friend of mine, I asked him when he's there, like, you know, dude, like, I know you. This doesn't make you bad, but you got to admit. He's like, no, I don't. That's not me. I don't. I'm like, you're full of shit. Don't lie. You know, come on. Like,
right? Because we're programmed. We're conditioned this way, right? So this is where that awareness. Except, yeah, those are the. That's why it's got to start somewhere, and you can't just jump right into action if you're not willing to recognize it in yourself, or if you're only recognizing it in others and not recognizing it in yourself. Then you're also part of the problem, too.
I'm thinking most that jump into action without the acceptance and awareness come in with, like, not all white people. The action's all lives matter. The action's really horrible.
Or it's them. It's them. It's those bad people.
Right.
See, they're white supremacists. They're the bad ones. I don't have any of that in me. Yeah, it's just you're still part of the problem and not helping.
Yeah, you jump in with the not all white people and the all lives matter. But we're about the top of an hour, and you know, I think it would be it would behoove us to keep this in the hour range. I don't want to spill all our podcast sausage making secrets, but if I don't like it, it ain't going to get done. If I don't enjoy doing it, it's going to be a struggle. And an hour is good for me. You good, Rev?
Yeah, I'm hoping to look at some of the things we have in action items here for some things that people can do that are kind of low-hanging fruit that hopefully, again, like me going and talking at my school or being part of this thing at my school, we've talked about it. Let's talk about it again. Safety Pin Box.
Yep.
SafetyPinBox.com. You can go right on there and download the sample task and get on their newsletter list if you want to put a toe in the water, or if financially that's the place that you can be. There is a place for you in that as just an example of the kinds of things that you can do. So that's a good place to start.
Yeah, and that was a good, the actual sample task involves action, not just sort of self-reflection education. And in fact, all of the, if you sign up and you become a member, the tasks you get all sort of have this week one, week two, week three, week four that follow a path of sort of, you know, first that same awareness, acceptance and action. It starts with this is the issue, the topic, the thing. You're going to understand it and learn about it. Then you're going to go research it, and then you're going to learn more about it locally, and then you're going to go do something about it locally. So I think that's a perfect action item. Did you see the other one related to the Dakota Access Pipeline?
I did, and this is an easy action. Let me see if I can pull it up. This is an easy action. It took me about a minute to actually do. So we'll put this link. We'll put this link in the show notes. It's and I'll just read the tweet that this came from. Is that okay with you?
Please.
Okay. It says this is urgent. A hashtag. No DAPL or no Dakota Pipeline, call for assistance. A bad outcome here would be devastating for our Standing Rock water protectors. This is legal sabotage. And what it's asking for is the fact that right now, evidently, there are not enough in-state lawyers, public defenders, to actually and to be able to defend the folks that are being arrested and having legal actions taken against them, which means that folks are very likely not going to get due process. So what's happening, and this is now part of this tweet again, and you can take a look at it in our link, the North Dakota Supreme Court has decided to take public comments on whether to allow out-of-state lawyers to represent water protectors for their trials. Comments are due by Friday at 4 o'clock on December 30th, 2016, and then written comments, it says where the written comments can be emailed to Penny Miller, clerk of the Supreme Court, at supcelerkofcourt@ndcourts.gov. And then there's an address. So you can take a look at this on the link. If you look at the whole thread, there's even a little further down, somebody who I'm going to guess is a lawyer or a clerk of some kind actually wrote kind of a template of what is the petition number and everything. So you can kind of cut and paste with your own information. It'll take you about a minute, and this is a way for folks all over the country. Evidently, the call is you don't have to be in North Dakota to participate in this public comments piece. So no matter where you are, if you want to support the water protectors that are being prosecuted, take literally a minute and send this email.
Yeah. We've talked on this show about what I've called, and I'm sure other people thought, Schrodinger's racist, right? How many racist folk and how many, decent folk do we have in this room? So they're soliciting public commentary. The Supreme Court is, and ostensibly, I don't know, but ostensibly, I assume the clerk and the Supreme Court in Dakota there are going to review these public comments and use them in weighing their decision as to whether or not to allow outside counsel to help support the Dakota Access Pipeline water protectors, right? So if nobody does anything, if everybody thinks someone will do something, if everyone says, I could do it, but I'm sure everyone else is doing it, I'll do something else. What happens, just like the comment section in newspapers and other places, it becomes a dumpster fire of racist hate. So you know Breitbart News is telling people to, write in and tell them no on this petition. Let this Dakota pipeline go through. Tell these social justice warriors no, blah, 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 blah. So it's actually important. This is important that folks take just a minute and do it. I'll also give my own experience. I was part of an action in Cleveland for the Year Without Tamir, and one of the individuals on the team got arrested. And when someone's arrested, the action's not over until that person's out of jail. So we're at the courthouse. We're doing everything we can to get this person out. And I'm telling you the dead ass truth. As soon as the amplification on Twitter and other places went out saying, okay, we know where this colleague is and they're at this particular jail and court, and we were trying to get them processed and out, call this number and ask for this person to be processed and let out. And it was pretty quick. I guarantee you I know that they mentioned people are literally, here's your friend. Tell people to stop calling the jail. Like literally, that's what they said. I'm like, they're pissed.
Yeah.
So this works. It works. And it didn't take thousands of people. It just takes the right number of people, and it takes some person. And with that, I'll go sort of our closing and remind folks that this is with acknowledgement and citation to Feminista Jones. Help, don't hinder. Support, don't supplant. Cooperate, don't co-opt. Solidarity, not charity. One person can make a difference. Your passion is a superpower. But Rev, thank you so much for your time. Another edition of the White Privilege Podcast. And really, I hope folks are enjoying this, because to me, this is just me and you chit-chatting. And we were doing this anyway, working our white mess out ourselves so as to not bother other folks with it. But hopefully this is valuable for folks. And if you've got thoughts, ideas, things you want Rev and I to address or talk about, tag us on Twitter. It's about the only social media I use. I'm a very white guy, and Rev is at Unruly Rev. That's UNRULYREV. But tag us, let us know what you think. Let us know if there's topics or things you want to address. Let us know if there's white mess you're dealing with, and let's work it out on the White Privilege Podcast. Yeah.
Sounds good.
All right. Until next time. Thanks, everybody.